Okay, Boker Tov, everybody. A pleasure to welcome. A pleasure to see everybody. And welcome to part three of Dr. Simkowitz's series on the Jews of ancient Egypt on behalf of Torah Motion. Today we're doing, I believe, the Jews of Alexandria. I just got off a meeting with Josh Berman, Dr. Josh Berman, of course, who wrote the book on biblical criticism, and he just returned from a trip to Egypt. So we're actually talking about his trip to Egypt. So I think that's sort of a nice segue into this. Vakasha Malka, it's all yours.
It's great to see everybody. Good morning. And I really appreciate those of you who have your cameras on because it really energizes me. And I'm seeing so many happy faces, smiling faces from all over the world. Last week, we talked about Leontopolis and Elephantine. We explored the temples that were built in these communities, used by observant, pious Jews who kept the main identifying markers of Jewish law, Shabbat, circumcision, and dietary laws. The self-perception of these Jews was that they were carrying out God's will. Presumably, they could not easily make it to the Jerusalem temple. And so they thought having a temple in their backyard would be better than not going to any temple at all. And these temples were not replacements for synagogues, but concurrent with the synagogues. So these communities also had synagogues where these Jews would gather together and read their scriptures and interpret them. The synagogues were not yet used for normative prayer at this early stage. We also talked about how Judeans, and we're going to really explore this next week, how Judeans did not have the same attitude towards these diasporan temples. And we looked briefly at a Mishnah, which talks about what is a worse violation, to bring an oath, to make an oath that you will bring a sacrifice, but then you know you cannot make it to the Jerusalem temple. So is it better to break the oath, break the vow, or bring that sacrifice to the temple of Chonya at Leontopolis? So we're going to set all of that aside, but if there was anything that I was not clear about or any questions, oh, thank you for the source sheet again. Any questions about what we talked about last week, I will try to leave some time at the end of the hour and you can ask a question on today's class or on our previous classes. I have to say that I've been waiting for today's class for a long time because there's something special about Alexandria. This is the crown jewel of the Roman Empire. This is the heart of what we call Western diasporan Jewry. It's a little sad that I'm ignoring the Eastern diaspora, what was Babylonia and then Persia, the heartland of the diasporan rabbis, but we simply do not have the literature from what's called the Eastern diaspora. We have material from the beginning of the Second Temple period, right? Daniel, Ezra, and Nehemiah. And then, of course, we have rabbinic literature. But when it comes to the late Second Temple period, we really don't have much from what scholars call the Eastern diaspora. I always say what scholars call because I think this is a very stupid phrase. Eastern diaspora, Western diaspora. The ancients did not think like this. And if you did not live in Judea, you probably didn't even think with the category diaspora at all. So we have to remember that these are modern terms. Sorry, I have to get my water. The Jews in Alexandria were a diverse set. And I kind of think of it like the New York City of the ancient world, because in addition to this very diverse community of Jews, you also have an incredibly diverse population. You have native Egyptians, right? You have Greeks. And then when Rome comes in the first century BCE, I think I talked about this. They sort of push the hierarchical caste system down and you have all kinds in Alexandria. Philo, we're going to see if we have time to look at the source inside. Philo says that the city was divided up into five parts, like a pie. And each part was named after a letter of the Greek alphabet, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon. And Philo says that until 38 CE, there were Jews in every section of the city, but really there were two sections that were predominantly Jewish. So can you imagine 40% of the city was considered Jewish sections of the city. And that's just the city itself. You have what we would call today the suburbs. You have this massive stretch of, it's not even wilderness, but just like sort of the spreading out of this massive community. A conservative estimate would be a couple hundred thousand people in this region. That's conservative. And I think we've talked about this before. How can it be when Devarim says Do not go back to this land, that Egypt was such a comfortable home to the Jewish people. And it's, you know, it's kind of a hop, skip, and a jump to Jerusalem. We're not talking about the trek from Babylonia to Jerusalem. That's a trek that's expensive and dangerous and risky, time consuming. Crossing the Sinai Desert is not the same thing. These Jews could have gone back. I'm not saying it was easy, but they could have gone back, and they don't. I want to focus on three sets of incidents, you might call them, in Alexandrian Jewish history that really give us a flavor of the tension between, on the one hand, the extreme success of the community, and on the other hand, the clashes that they encountered with anti-Jewish individuals and government officials. And of course, that is the tension at the heart of Jewish history, right? On the one hand, Jews are incredibly successful at the social, economic, political levels. We saw that, remember, with Onias, who helped Cleopatra, and his two sons, who were loyal to Cleopatra when she was in a civil war with her son, remember, towards the end of the second century BCE. So as Jews are increasingly successful, they are also increasingly exposing themselves to anti-Jewish violence. So three things we're going to look at. We're going to look at a legend called the letter of Aristeas. This is the earliest text we have that concerns the translation of the Hebrew Bible, but really just the Torah, the first five books, into Greek at the end of the third century BCE. I'm sure you know that the rabbis have a very famous legend about this, with the 70 Judean scholars, each of them going to different rooms. They come out and they produce the same exact text. And that rabbinic tradition speaks to this special sort of authority and status of what will be called the Septuagint. But Aristeas is maybe four centuries or more older than this rabbinic text. Again, it's a second century BCE text, but the story takes place earlier, in the 320s BCE, under the jurisdiction of Ptolemy II Philadelphus. Now, you already know I hate to share my screen because I need to see your faces, but I will share my screen soon, and we're going to look at this source inside. How does Aristeas present the story of the translation of the Torah? And what are the big messages that Aristeas wants to convey? Some scholars say, well, the argument is that the author wants to present the Septuagint as equally legitimate to the Tanakh. But again, it's not the Tanakh, it's the Torah. The Septuagint, the whole Tanakh, is translated over the course of maybe two or three centuries. But this is the translation of the first five books. So some say, well, he's trying to argue for the legitimacy, the equal status of the Septuagint in comparison to the Tanakh. Others say, no, actually, he thinks it's superior to the Hebrew version. I don't read Aristeas as really being just about the translation of the Hebrew text into Greek. It's really much more. The author is attentive to two sets of relationships, the Jew-Greek relationship and the diasporan-Judean relationship. And both of those relationships, the author argues, are relationships founded on kinship, mutuality, and friendship. So there's a much bigger polemic going on that argues for the integrity of diasporan Judaism, which really has almost nothing to do with the Septuagint itself. Of course, the story is about the Septuagint and it legitimizes the Septuagint, but really the story is about the argument for the legitimacy of diaspora Judaism. That's the first thing we're going to look at. I'm going to ask that, unless you really need clarification now on something I just said, that we hold questions for the end. So is iPhone (2) close parentheses, is this a question that you need clarified now, or can it wait till the end? Okay, well, I think that that might be a mistake, so we're just going to keep going. All right, the second text we're going to look at is a work called Three Maccabees. And this work is preserved in the Apocrypha, so that means that it was preserved in the Catholic tradition as authoritative, as canonical. It's not, of course, canonical in the Jewish tradition. It's written in Alexandria, which is why we're going to look at it today, probably produced in the second century BC, although some scholars put it as late as the first century CE. We don't know. Let's call it late Second Temple. And it's a sort of revision of the Book of Esther. It's about a crisis that the Alexandrian Jewish community experiences when their king Ptolemy gets very angry at them for, this is interesting, for the Judean refusal of allowing Ptolemy to enter the Jerusalem temple. That Judean refusal causes Ptolemy to take vengeance on the Alexandrian community. You can already get a sense of the polemic, which argues that Kol Yisrael Arevim Zelazeh, right? This is a story which argues that the diasporan community is held accountable for the Judean community's actions. And that argument really is a diasporan argument, because the Judean sources, I think we've talked about this a little bit, are much more, I would say, paternalistic. We're talking much more about sort of Judean exceptionalism. But the idea that all Jews are accountable for one another and interconnected is a very diasporan idea. So that is the second thing we're going to look at. Finally, we're going to look at a very dark chapter of Alexandrian Jewish history, and that is the pogrom of 38 to 39 CE. And this, there's so much more to talk about, but I don't even think we're going to get to these sources. So I'm going to, we're going to stick with these three incidents. Okay. I'm not going to read questions now unless there's a question regarding clarification that you need. So I would ask if you could hold off on typing those questions till the end of the hour, and then we'll address them. All right. The third incident takes place when the Judean client King Agrippa passes through the city of Alexandria in 38. As of 6 CE, Judea is incorporated fully into the Roman Empire. This is actually really important history, so I'm just going to back it up to 63 BCE. 63 BCE is not sufficiently commemorated by contemporary Jews, but it was a disaster of a year. That was the end of the Hasmonean period. The Hasmonean period lasts exactly a century, from 164 to 63 BCE. In 63, the Roman general Pompey invades Jerusalem, and basically that's the beginning of Roman occupation. But it's not until 6 CE that Judea is completely incorporated. We have this process of client kings, right? And I'm sure you know about Antipater and his son Herod. Ooh, everyone gets the willies when they hear the word Herod. And then Herod intermarries with the Hasmonean family and sort of murders all of them. But then we have this very complicated, interconnected Herodian-Hasmonean family tree. And these figures are essentially puppets of Rome, particularly after 6 CE, where they report to the Roman Empire, but they're running the local affairs of Judea. And so one such descendant of the Herodian-Hasmonean family, his name is Agrippa, and he knows he's very unpopular among sort of elite Roman circles. He also has very close ties to Roman officials. He was brought up as a sort of like very fancy kid, Jewish kid in Rome, sort of like the child of a diplomat. The diplomat lives on the Upper East Side of New York, but sends his child to boarding school in Geneva, right? You have these like fancy European boarding schools for American kids, but they're in Europe. So that's kind of how Agrippa was reared, very elite, brought up in Rome. Anyway, so he always goes back and forth between Jerusalem and Rome. And on one such visit, when he's traveling from Rome to Jerusalem and he passes through Alexandria, he knows he's very unpopular, and he's careful to only get off the dock of the boat to sort of stretch his legs in the middle of the night because he doesn't want anyone to see him. But word spreads that he's in town, and riots break out. And these riots become very, very serious. Synagogues are vandalized. Sefer Torah scrolls are ripped apart, thrown all over. Glass is smashed. I'm trying to conjure up Kristallnacht because that is exactly how Philo's description sounds. Hundreds of Jews are killed. Thousands of others flee the city. It's a horrible incident. Philo goes to Rome to appeal on behalf of the Jews. I think that I've mentioned this in earlier weeks. And unfortunately for him, the Roman emperor at the time is Gaius Caligula, who laughs him out of the court. Now, the story does not end there, because a year later, Caligula, who, as if you know anything about Caligula, you know he's maybe not the most emotionally stable of emperors. And the bar is very low when it comes to first century Roman emperors. Caligula decides it would be a great plan to put an image of himself in the Jerusalem temple. Ah, is it Agrippa I or Agrippa II? So that's a good question. It's probably Agrippa I. Agrippa II would have been, so we know Agrippa II from a few places. First of all, from the book of Acts in the New Testament. And he was a client king of Judea with his sister Berenike in the 50s CE. And so he comes up as one of the people responsible for Paul's arrest. I did promise I wasn't going to answer questions, but I read that one so easily that I'm just addressing it. Look in the chat if you want to see what I'm responding to. And also in the Mishnah, there's a beautiful a reference to Agrippa that would probably be Agrippa too, but we're not sure. In the Mishnah, Agrippa is reading the Torah and he comes to the Pasuk and says, it's a Pasuk, I think, Devarim, that says you shouldn't have foreign kings over you. And he starts to cry because he's aware of his Herodian lineage and the Herodian family was never fully accepted as Jews, even though they were converts. In any case, he's crying and the rabbis are comforting and saying, no, Agrippa, you're our brother. You're our brother. It's a very beautiful image. That scholars disagree. Is that Agrippa 1, Agrippa 2? Consensus is that's Agrippa 2. Agrippa 2 would be in the 50s. This is probably Agrippa 1. So for the one person on the chat who knows about, you know, or maybe all of you know about Agrippa 1, Agrippa 2, a lot of the sources are not clear because it's not like Philo saying Agrippa 1. In any case, Caligula decides to put an image of himself in the Jerusalem temple. There's a massive uproar, not just on the part of Judean Jews, but on the part of diasporan Jews as well. Public protests on the part of Jews. Philo says thousands of people are showing up in the cities to protest. At the last minute, Caligula changes his mind. So the Alexandrian Jews have a lot of political power. And Philo's own nephew was an apostate who was very involved in local Roman affairs of Egypt. Okay, so again, we're sort of dividing this class up into three parts. We're going to look at Aristeas. We're going to look at three Maccabees. And we're going to look at, if we have time, some of the Philo passages about those years between 38 and 40. And I should say one thing we're not going to look at is the sort of official end of the golden age of Alexandrian Jewry. And that is the War of Quietus in 115 to 118 CE. We have a few rabbinic sources about this war, but what we know also from other Roman historians like Dio Cassius is that there was a diasporan Jewish rebellion against the Roman Empire in 115. So it's again one of these things that like people don't know about. There was a diasporan rebellion against the yoke of Rome. And one of the hearts of that rebellion takes place in Alexandria. And Trajan the emperor has no mercy. He goes into communities, specifically into the Jewish community of Cyprus, where there's another sort of just like a center of the rebellion, and he murders tens of thousands of Jews. This is known in rabbinic texts as the War of Quietus. Quietus was the name of the general put in charge of putting down this rebellion. And that is really sort of the end of the golden age of this community. And so we have these extremes when we talk about this community of Jews in Alexandria, on the one hand, enormously successful, and on the other hand, really besought by anti-Jewish violence that's sort of below the surface all the time and then rises above it when things get tense. Again, to me, the history of this community is so resonant with contemporary experience. Well, I guess I finally have to show my screen, so I'm going to do it. And we're going to start with Aristeas, the second century BCE document. Let's see if you see what I see. The letter of Aristeas. You see that? Okay, I mean, I could spend 5 to 6 hours just on this text. So I'm really going to have to pace myself. So the text is framed as a letter from Aristeas to his brother or his friend. And the account is presented as an account, again, of the circumstances in which Ptolemy II Philadelphus takes the initiative to have the Torah translated officially. Whether or not that's exactly how it happens, scholars don't necessarily think that Ptolemy, the great king, was burning with, you know, this desire to translate this work. It's, of course, polemical. But in any case, let's see what's going on here. So this king at the end of the 3rd century BCE is building the best library in the world, the famous Alexandrian Library. And he has someone in charge of this library. His name is Demetrius of Phalerum. And Demetrius has all this money at his disposal to translate all the wise, you know, the greatest books in the world, translate them into Greek and put them in the library. How many books are in this library? The king asked Demetrius, over 200,000. Now, that might not be impressive to you in this digital age where so much billions of books can be accessed just on Amazon, but 200,000 books in one place when the process of copying a book was so laborious and expensive and time consuming in the ancient world, this would have been unprecedented, incomparable to any other library in the Hellenistic world. This was the greatest library. And then Demetrius says, yes, we have 200,000 works. I would like for us to have 500,000 works. And you know what I really want to do? Demetrius says to the king, I want to translate the laws of the Jews. And here the Greek would be nomoi, but nomos for a Greek speaking Jew was also the main word for the Torah. I want to translate the scriptures. So I don't know that laws is the best translation here. I would say the authoritative scriptures of the Jewish people. And so the king says, what's to prevent you from doing this? Go ahead. Everything that's necessary is placed at your disposal. And Demetrius is like, not so simple. It's not just that they need to be translated. It's that the Jews use a peculiar alphabet, just as the Egyptians do. And this maybe is referencing hieroglyphics. They also have a special form of letters. They speak a peculiar dialect. And this interesting comparison between the native Egyptians and the Jews, that is something that we often miss when we talk about Jewish history, is how deeply connected the Jews feel. Remember, this is a Jewish work. And the Jews feel so deeply connected to Egypt. That's why we need this polemic. Don't go back. The Jews are drawn. It's like a magnet pulling them back to Egypt. They feel so connected to Egypt. And so there's this comparison. Yes, they have a peculiar dialect. They have a special form of letters. They're supposed to use a Syriac tongue. That's very interesting. Syriac is in the family of various Aramaic dialects. But in any case, they don't use that. The Syriac language, by the way, is an Aramaic dialect that uses Greek letters. Fascinating. So anyway, the king is like, go ahead and do what you need to do. And Demetrius is like, okay, we need to contact authorities in Judea and ask them to send us 72 scholars who will come to Alexandria and translate this text. Now, as a gesture of goodwill, the local Jews of Alexandria make a request of Ptolemy to Philadelphus. They say, we know that in your conflicts with other Hellenistic kingdoms, specifically the Seleucids to the north of Judea, in your various conflicts, you have acquired Jewish captives from Judea. Release these captives as a gesture of goodwill to the Jewish community. So again, there's a sort of kinship. The Jews in Alexandria are caring about the Judean Jews. There's this mutuality. There's this friendship. And that's a diasporan polemic, right? We Alexandrian Jews, we want to support you in this project, but please release the captives of our Jewish cousins from Judea that is under your jurisdiction. And on what basis should you do so? The Jews petition Ptolemy. Well, it's because you don't understand something about the Jews. They worship your God. We all worship the same God, the overseer and creator of all. We think of the Hellenistic world as being polytheist, but at this time there was already a notion of the father God, whether that would be Zeus, Jove, right, or Jupiter, right? There was already an emerging, I wouldn't call it monotheism, but an emerging idea that there was an originator God, a primary God. So they worship God, the overseer and creator of all, whom all men worship, including ourselves. Okay. We have a different name, right? Their name for him is Zeus and Jove. Our name for him is Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And so the argument, again, it's a twofold argument. Jews and Greeks should be on the same level in terms of their integrity and friendship, and diasporan Jews and Judean Jews have this friendship of mutuality. So this argument that diasporan Judaism is legitimate has to go in both directions, in the Jew-Greek direction and in the diaspora Judea direction. Anyway, I suppose I have to up my pace, but in any case, I want to point you to the response of the Judean community. So Ptolemy sends a letter to the Jerusalem authorities saying, send us 72 scholars, 6 for each tribe, which is interesting, of course, because like 10 tribes have been lost since 722 BCE. But in any case, send us 72 scholars and we will ask those scholars to translate the Hebrew Bible, the Hebrew Torah into Greek for our library. And what does the high priest Eleazar say? What a fantastic idea. I absolutely will do this. Again, could this possibly be a historical letter? I don't think so. sorry, I taught a lot last night, so I've already lost my voice. We have a lot of early rabbinic texts which express ambivalence about translation. Now, it is true that the rabbis view the Septuagint as having kind of special status in contrast with other translations, and Greek is discussed as a possible language that you could recite the Torah. And nevertheless, there was ambivalence about this translated version of the Septuagint, not in this diasporan version. Here, the diasporan writer depicts the high priest Eleazar, the highest, most important central religious leader of Judea, and says, what a fantabulous idea. We read your letter publicly to all the people because we were so excited. We wanted them to know your piety towards our God. We showed them all the presents that you sent us. We were so flattered by the two gentlemen that you sent as emissaries with these presents, Andreas and Aristeas. Outstanding in education, worthy in every respect of your conduct and justice, on and on and on. Everything which is to your advantage, even if it is unnatural, we will carry out. What does he mean by unnatural? I can't tell you. I don't have a satisfactory understanding of what this means. So I just want to leave it sort of as a question mark. What is Eleazar talking about? What would be unnatural? Is it the translation itself? Is it having the scholars go down to Egypt? I do not know. But this is a very jarring qualification. This is a sign, however, of friendship and love, that we're not necessarily doing this because we, you know, would have initiated the project ourselves, but we love you on a personal level. And so we will honor you by supporting this project. All right, that's all I'm going to do over here. Again, we have to read this text, not as a Judean one, but as a diasporan one, with the imagining of Eleazar being so supportive of the diasporan community of Egypt. And Aristeas goes on to describe these scholars who are brought down from Jerusalem, from Judea to Alexandria. And I love this description because it sounds modern Orthodox. I just think this is fabulous. Like, if I had to define modern Orthodoxy of the ancient world, here's how I would describe it. Eleazar selects 70 men of the highest merit, of excellent education, due to the distinction of their parentage, so from important families. But lineage is not the only important qualification here. They had not only mastered the Jewish literature, but Torah Umada, they had made a serious study of that of the Greeks as well. They were therefore well qualified for the embassy, right? Because they had really, really strong control of the Greek language and the Hebrew language. Please, if you're sending me messages, I'm not going to see them. I really appreciate it, but I'm not going to be able to see them. You can always email me if you want to send messages, but you don't want it to be public. You can always email me at msimkovich.edu. Okay, so they were therefore well qualified for the embassy and brought it to fruition as occasion demanded. They had a tremendous natural facility for the negotiations and questions arising from the law. So that suggests that there's some kind of oral tradition that the author is aware of. In addition to the actual text of the scriptures, there's an oral tradition, right? You're interpreting, you're asking questions, you're negotiating. But what's so special about these individuals that they found a middle way as their commendable ideal, that they knew the Greek literature, they knew the Jewish literature, and they had the perfect balance, totally God-fearing and committed to their ancestral traditions, and yet they had an appreciation of Greek culture. I mean, if that's not modern Orthodoxy, I don't know what is. In any case, no, that's really academically irresponsible of me to take a modern term and just flop it onto the second century BC. So do not quote me on that. And so these Judean scholars are brought down to Alexandria, where they have, I did not include this on the list, on the source sheet, but the author here goes through a whole lengthy aside on the rationality of Jewish law, and specifically on the rationality of the dietary laws, on and on and on and on. If you have a source sheet, you could look at this on your own. One thing I did not include, and I'll just stop short just to see your faces, is that the climax of this book is a symposium, a feast that lasts for many weeks. And the feast is characterized by the king asking every one of the scholars a philosophical question about piety and leadership. And each question and answer is recorded in the book, and they all speak to the wisdom and the integrity of the Jewish tradition. And so in that scene, the Jewish tradition is presented as a philosophy that supports but also exceeds in integrity and superiority. It exceeds in every way the Greek wisdom tradition. And the book closes with the establishment of a big celebration, a big festival celebrating this translation. Philo of Alexandria a few centuries later, would affirm that there was an annual celebration commemorating this event as something very positive and wonderful. But the question of the actual status of the Septuagint vis-a-vis the Torah, the Hebrew Torah, is never fully settled, right? This is a polemic, and you need polemics when things are not clear on the ground, when there's actual ambiguity. We know that things were not clear because of that later rabbinic literature that really struggles with the status of translated texts of the scriptures that were viewed by Jews in the diaspora as authoritative. But this text, Aristeas, argues for, again, I don't think it argues for the superiority of the Septuagint over the Torah, but certainly the equal status of it. So that's Aristeas. And we have about 20 minutes left to talk about Three Maccabees and Philo, but and we'll just keep plugging along and see what we can get done. Three Maccabees, like I said, it's very hard to date. And whereas Aristeas presents a beautiful picture of hearts and flowers, everyone's friends, everyone gets along, the Jews and the Greeks, the diasporan Jews, the Judean Jews, everyone's best friends. Three Maccabees is a much darker work. Think of it as an updated version of the Esther story. The setting is I think it's in 217 BCE. The setting is the Battle of Raphia, which is a major conflict between the Ptolemaic kingdom and the Seleucid kingdom. Remember that as of 323 BCE, after Alexander the Great dies, all of his territory is divided into three main parts: the Ptolemies in North Africa, right? Egypt and elsewhere. The Seleucids in the north of Judea, and the Antiochids to the right in Asia. And of course, Judea is stuck in the middle, prime real estate. Everybody wants Judea. It's right in the middle. And the six Syrian wars, that's what these conflicts are known as. The six Syrian wars are the conflicts between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies over territory that includes Judea. And that takes place over the third century BCE. By the way, that's why everything is hunky-dory for the Jews in Judea from 323 until 200, because they're living under the Ptolemies. And the Ptolemies are quite tolerant. The problem happens when the Seleucids take Judea. They wrest Judea. They get that territory back from the Ptolemies, and the Seleucids are not quite as nice. And that's why the Jews are actually not in conflict with Hellenism for at least 120, 130 years. It's only when they fall under the control of the Seleucids. So Three Maccabees, the setting is the Ptolemaic victory over the Seleucids at the Battle of Raphia at the end of the third century BC. But this was probably written about 100 years later, or maybe even more than that. And in this story, I'm going to sort of not do this inside the text because of time constraints. But in this story, the Ptolemaic king, Philopator, wants to celebrate his victory over the Seleucids by entering the Jerusalem temple. This was a typical thing for a Hellenistic king to do. I had this grand victory. I want to go into, whatever local town I'm in and go into the temple and bring an altar to the local god. That's, typical what you would do in the ancient Near East. You would worship the gods that were local to you. So if you'd go to one place, you'd bring a god to Isis in Egypt. If you went to Mesopotamia, you'd bring God to, Asherah. Well, I don't think Asherah was around by this late stage. But in any case, so this was not considered an act of disrespect. It was considered an act of homage. And the Jews absolutely freak out. They say, you know what? This is just not going to happen, Philopater. You can't. And he's saying, well, look, I'm impressed by its excellence, its beauty. I'm marveling at this. I want to actually go into all the way in. And, that's what I'm going to do. I'm the king. Gosh darn it. And the Jews just don't know what to do. And they start crying and sobbing. They're praying. The priests and all their best men prostrate themselves. They entreated the supreme God to aid in the present situation. By the way, has anybody read the book of 2 Maccabees? It's 3 Maccabees. It has nothing to do with Maccabees. Has anyone read 2 Maccabees? Oh, it was not in the source sheets. I know, because as I've said in previous weeks, I tinker until the very last minute. And that is just, you just got to accept it. We all have foibles and flaws. I added this at 11:30 p.m. last night. I would be glad to send a revised source sheet to Jay, or you can email me, but that's just what I do late at night. I add all kinds of things. So 2 Maccabees talks about the Hasmonean rebellion against the Syrian Greeks. It's specifically set in the years, 175 to the 140s BCE. But in any case, there's a parallel story there of a general named Heliodorus who wants to enter the temple. It's almost exactly the same story, and that's in 2 Maccabees 3. So there's a big scholarly question of like how these two traditions interact. In any case, everybody's crying, sobbing, praying in mourning because their holy temple is about to be violated by this foreign king. And there's this very elaborate Hellenistically styled prayer that the high priest Shimon says to God. And it's, again, this is taking place in Jerusalem, but it's in Alexandria. And this is a diasporan text. And I'll tell you how we know that in a couple minutes. And he bends his knees. It's very Hellenistic too. I mean, this is written in Greek. He's extending his hands. It's almost like I thought I was sharing. Sorry, I had to go back to sharing. There we go. Sorry about that. Okay. So he's bending his knees and he's extending his hands with calm dignity. And he's praying, Lord, Lord, King of the heavens, sovereign of all creation, holy among the holy ones, praying and crying. So it's Hellenistic because you can sort of see how it's being staged on a play. But some of these phrases come from Hebrew liturgy and he's borrowing biblical language as well. Reminds me of the scholars described in Aristeas who both know the Greek tradition and the biblical Hebrew one. All right, and this long prayer, why does this matter? Because there's a miracle that happens and Ptolemy becomes paralyzed and he can't enter into the temple. Suddenly, the God who oversees all things hears the supplication, scourged him who had exalted himself in insolence and audacity, and he becomes paralyzed and then just humiliated, and Ptolemy sort of goes back to Alexandria, totally embarrassed and ashamed that some mysterious malady afflicted him and he could not enter the Jerusalem temple. But of course, this is a miracle. After he recovers, he says, I'm not done with these Jews. I'm going to punish them, but I'm going to punish the Jews of Alexandria. And again, very similar to Aristeas, there's a presentation here of the polity of global Jewry united in destiny. So what happens to the Judean Jews affects the diasporan Jews. What happens to the diasporan Jews affects the Judean Jews. And this presentation of kinship and mutuality, it's a very diasporan idea. In any case, Ptolemy says, I'm going to kill all the Jews of Alexandria. And this is where you get very strong similarities with the story of Esther. He says, I'm going to gather all the Jews in Alexandria into the hippodrome, into this big arena where they would have the horse races, and I'm going to murder them. I don't want to spend so much more time on this, but you can all easily find 3 Maccabees online. In any case, what happens in Judea exactly parallels what happens in Alexandria. The people cry and they wail and they beg God for intervention, and a miracle happens. And the miracle, well, actually what's significant is that the high priest's prayer parallels, I don't know if I put it on here, the prayer of a priest who lives in Alexandria, Elazar. So just like Shimon, Simon, the high priest in Jerusalem, prays that Ptolemy will not enter the Jerusalem temple, so too we have a scene where the Jews are gathered into the hippodrome in Alexandria. They're about to be murdered, and Elazar prays and he calls upon God to remember his past salvation of the Jews when they were in crisis. What I find very fascinating is that unlike the Judean prayer, this prayer alludes specifically to diasporan forces and diasporan crises, right? Elazar refers to the companions in Babylon, that's Daniel and his friends, who were saved by God. And the argument here is, God, yes, you've saved the people of the land of Israel, the Jews of Judea, but also you've saved the Jews of the diaspora. Look upon us now and save us. So clearly the parallel scenes are meant to argue Jews share a common destiny. And what do you know? Just as Elazar is ending his prayer, the king arrives at the hippodrome with his, he's going to trample them with elephants, drunken elephants. And the Jews observe this and they're freaking out and they're crying. And then something happens. The most glorious, almighty and true God reveals his holy face and opens the heavenly gates from which 2 glorious angels of fearful aspect descended, visible to all but the Jews. Again, if you look at 2 Maccabees, chapter 3, you'll see an almost identical story. Here they oppose the forces of the enemy. They fill them with confusion and terror, binding them with immovable shackles. The king began to shudder bodily. He forgot his sullen insolence, but this time he repents. The king's anger is turned to pity and tears because of the things that he had devised beforehand. For when he had heard the shouting and saw them all fall in headlong to destruction, he wept and angrily threatened his friends. So he blames them for encouraging him to annihilate this wonderful group of people. You're committing treason. You're surpassing tyrants in cruelty. And even me, your benefactor, you are now attempting to deprive of dominion and life by secretly devising acts of no advantage to the kingdom. So you thought it would be a good idea to get rid of these Jews. How dare you? In fact, it would do nothing for us. Release the children of the Almighty and living God of heaven, who from the time of our ancestors until now has granted an unimpeded and notable stability to our government, because that is what the Greeks are constantly accusing the Jews of, destabilizing their lives, right? What does Haman say to Ahasuerus? Yishno am achan mefuzar mefurad mikol amim, right? Umachuteim, what is it? Shonot mikol, the dateim shonot mikol am, right? The dateim hamelach in amosim, right? They're outsiders, they're destabilizers, they're disloyal. And that is the thread of anti-Judaism that we find in Greek and Roman sources in the late Second Temple period. And this text says, no, Jews are assets to these diasporan host governments. In any case, the story is really like the diasporan, or I wouldn't, not diasporan, because we don't know enough about the providence of Esther to say, but it's like an updated version of the Esther story with a very specific orientation towards the diasporan community. What is the historical context of 3 Maccabees? There's just too much disagreement among scholars to say. I would treat it, first of all, I mean, there's almost no debate that it's Alexandrian. That was written originally in Greek. It has that Greek style, that flourish that you see in those kinds of texts. It could have been written in the 2nd century BCE. That's where I would put it. But some scholars, like I said, they put it much later due to the historical conflict that we know took place in 38 to 39 CE. Some scholars say it was written after that. But we talked 2 weeks ago about how there were conflicts for this community in the 2nd century BCE. Remember when the Jews remained loyal to Cleopatra, but the majority of those Jews in Egypt are not loyal to her. And so the Jews who support Cleopatra become very much resented. So this could have come out of that tension, that social conflict in the 2nd century BCE. But now I know that there's been comments and questions in the chat. And so I really want to make sure we have time to talk, but I'm going to, say a little more about, please don't send me private messages. I will not see them. Please just email me and I promise you, Lee Mender, I will respond. I'm not reading private messages. Thank you. So I want to close this conversation by looking at the historical sources that we have. Some might say it's not historical, it's polemic, whatever you want to call it. The text written by the great philosopher in Alexandria, Philo. And so I'm going to share my screen and let's take a look at our friend Philo. Philo gets a bad rap as someone who is Hellenized, whose writings are corrupted by Aristotelian philosophy. This is just simply not the case. Philo is an observant Jew. Of course, he is an absolute expert. He has total facility in Greek philosophy, but his main program is to argue for the philosophical integrity and superiority of the Jewish tradition. He's totally committed to that idea. And when Jews are attacked in Alexandria on the basis, yes, technically it's because of Agrippa's visit, but really it's because this anti-Judaism has been fomenting, because Jews are resented for so long. Philo feels that he has to make a case. He has to defend the very existence of diasporan Jewry itself. And he says, listen up, people. You don't understand what Jews are. You don't understand who they're loyal to. Let me be very clear. No one country can contain the whole Jewish nation by reason of its populousness. We're too many people. And again, this reminds me of these debates in contemporary times. What are the Jews? Race, people, nation, ethnicity? On which account they frequent all the most prosperous and fertile countries of Europe and Asia, with their islands or continents. But they look upon the holy city, Jerusalem, as their metropolis. If you know a little bit of Greek, you know this means mother city, in which is erected the sacred temple of the Most High God. So yes, you're right. We have dual loyalties. We absolutely are loyal to that sacred city, our motherland. But accounting those regions which have been occupied by our fathers, our grandfathers, our great-grandfathers, we've been here for centuries. We have, our remote ancestors have lived in the diaspora. And so guess what? We belong here too. What is this? This is our fatherland. Here's where we've been brought up. This is our country. There are even some regions to which the Jews came the very moment that they were originally settled, such as, actually, Josephus says, Alexandria would have been one of those places. They send a colony of their people to do a pleasure to the founders of the company, right? We're doing a favor. We're enhancing the societies that we colonize. It doesn't have a bad connotation in this translation. And there was reason to fear, lest all the population in every country taking what was done in Egypt. In other words, there was reason to fear that the riots against the Jews in Egypt would spread to other communities. And then he goes on to describe what anti-Jewish regulations took place in the wake of these anti-Jewish riots. There were five districts of the city. Remember, I said that to you after five letters of the alphabet. Two of them were called the quarters of the Jews, even though I don't know what one fifth would be. It's not a quarter, because the chief portion of the Jews lives in them. And there were also scattered Jews elsewhere. But what did the Romans do? They drove the Jews entirely out of four quarters. They crammed them all into a very small portion of one. And by reason of their numbers, they were dispersed over the seashore and desert places. So in other words, they couldn't all fit in this tiny portion. They had to go to the outside cemeteries. They had to flee. Also, this is in the wake of the Jewish violence. They had to leave the city. They were deprived of all their property. So in the wake of anti-Jewish violence, the Jews were forced into tiny spaces. Many of them, you know, knew that they were unsafe there. They left the city. They were hiding in the wilderness. Meanwhile, the houses that they abandoned were turned to plunder, and the Romans divided the booty among themselves as if they had obtained it in war. You really, if you have time, should read this entire treatise, because the description of what happened to the Jews in Alexandria in the wake of Agrippa's visit is really shocking and vividly portrayed. There's one last paragraph that I want to show you, which I think is just extremely powerful. It's the very, very end of a treatise called Embassy to Gaius. Remember I said Philo went to Gaius Caligula. He asked Caligula to intervene on behalf of the Jews. Caligula refuses. It's all laid out in this treatise. I almost said tractate, in this treatise. And it ends with a sort of appeal to the Greek or Roman reader to intervene in the reality, in the wake of this anti-Jewish violence. And he says as follows. It was owing to these considerations, we were able to hold up our heads for a while, but there were other circumstances which terrified us and kept us in great, great perplexity and distress to hear what the emperor would decide, what he would pronounce, what kind of sentence he would ultimately deliver. So it's unclear whether the emperor would take any action against those who perpetrated violence against the Jewish people. It turns out that they did basically nothing. Surely it was a situation that the fate of all Jews everywhere should rest precariously on us five envoys. So the five Jews who went to Rome to appeal on behalf of the Alexandrian community, Philo says, all world Jewry was dependent on us. What does he mean by that, all world Jewry? Isn't he just representing the Jews of Alexandria? Philo explains, for if the king should decide in favor of our enemies and not prosecute those who sanctioned anti-Jewish violence, what other city will keep tranquil or refrain from attacking its fellow inhabitants? In other words, the tolerance of violence against the Jews of Alexandria will empower anti-Jews, right, people who hate Jews in other regions of the Hellenistic world to do the same thing and attack their Jewish neighbors. What house of prayer in the entire Roman world, if you're not thinking about contemporary times, I mean, you should, what house of prayer will be left unscathed? What kind of civic rights will not be upset for those whose lot is cast under the ancient institutions of the Jews? Every Jew will be in danger if you do not prosecute those individuals who killed Jews in Alexandria. First upset, in other words, first destabilized, then shipwrecked, then sunk to the very bottom, will be both their peculiar, he doesn't mean this in a bad way, but their ancestral laws and the rights which they enjoy in common in every city. You want to endanger the Jews? Don't prosecute. You want to make sure that the Jews survive? Do the right thing. Waterlogged by such considerations, we were dragged down and submerged in the depths, for those who hitherto seemed to be acting with us gave up. Those who thought, or those who claimed to be our allies, in fact, in the end, did nothing for us, did not stand by us, did not protect us, and made every Jew in the Roman world vulnerable. That's Embassy to Gaius. Anybody who wants to know the patterns of anti-Jewish violence should read that work. Whew, lots of stuff here. Okay. Again, I'm not going to be sending emails to anybody, so please email me and send me questions if you don't want to put them on the public chat. All right, so let's just go through some of this. Do I think that authors of Three Maccabees were aware of the story of Megillah Esther? 100%, yes. It absolutely seems to be the case. And we also know that the story by this time was being read, right? We have a Greek version of Esther also that was produced in the second century BCE that has some additions to the story that inserts God and religious sort of elements, references to biblical history. That's what's known as Greek Esther. So certainly the Jews, it would be almost impossible for them to not have known the story of Esther. Yes, I know Esther is not in the Dead Sea caves. Nevertheless, yes, I think that the author knew Esther. Yes, 2 out of 5 districts are Jewish. Well, I wouldn't say are Jewish, but have many, many Jews in that in those sections. So yes, close to 40%. I mean, that's unbelievable. That's why I think of it as like the lower, those sections are like the Lower East Side of New York City. What took so long to translate? And I do see that there are hand raised. So I want to make sure that people have time to also articulate questions. 2 out of 5 districts. Oh, no, I already read that one. What took so long to translate the Torah into Greek? Surely many Jews in Egypt and somewhere and elsewhere only spoke Greek. And so this is a great question. And most scholars think that the Septuagint was not the first translation in Greek of the scriptures. There were likely other translations of the Hebrew Bible, but they were sort of unofficial, local, casually used. And so this version was meant to be the formal official version that all Greek speaking Jews would use. And so some scholars do say Aristeas, part of the goal of the book is to establish itself as authoritative over other versions that were circulating, but they weren't sort of normative. So unfortunately, what people were doing is they were translating for their themselves or their communities, but on a local level. So there were multiple such versions. With regard to the establishment of a community of Jews in Alexandria versus Devarim, could it imply, I don't get into authorship on such conversations. Perhaps it would imply the authorship of Devarim much later. I'm not convinced of that. I don't know that this brings to bear anything about the authorship of Devarim. I'm not a scholar of Devarim. Okay, I'm going to answer these two questions, but then I'm going to take Kenneth's question. Is there a remnant of a Jewish community in Alexandria today? Yeah, I'm in a Facebook group of the Jews of Alexandria. There were maybe up to like 10 years ago, a couple dozen, and now maybe not even that. It's a tiny, tiny community of Jews. It's basically nothing. But there is an initiative on the part of some officials in Egypt to preserve Jewish sites. And I don't know what the future is, but recently they renovated an ancient, not like Second Temple, but a centuries old synagogue. Actually, I think that I included a picture of that synagogue on the source sheet. And so they're doing some restorative work on ancient Jewish sites, but the Jews are not there. Is Aristeas a fake? There's no such thing as a fake in the ancient world. Nothing is a fake, right? Every text is real. I'm reading the words. So it can't be fake because the words are there. What do I mean? What does it mean fake? I don't think it's a fake. I'm sorry to be a little harsh. Also, I ask everybody to please mute yourselves. Thank you, because there's some background there. No, nothing is fake, right? But there's also, oh, that's interesting about Eli Kahn. What is a fake? Is this a piece of history? Is this factual? I mean, nothing in the Hellenistic world was even the formal histories that were produced by those officials working for Roman emperors were producing objective histories. Every history in the ancient world is polemical. I take this text very seriously as a document with historical value. Yeah, I thought he was Syrian too, but maybe his family's from Alexandria. All right, Kenneth is being very patient. Please, Kenneth.
All right, thank you, Malka. Firstly, I'd like to thank you for a very incisive presentation. It was very intellectual and very well done. I have a question. I don't know if you plan to touch on the Jewish philosophy of the Jews of Alexandria in reference to Hellenism and Judaism. I'm sure you're aware of Martin Hengel's work on Judaism and Hellenism in two volumes. And he discusses the fact that the Alexandrian Jews took stimuli from Greek thought, no doubt, Hellenism, and tried to deal with it in incorporating it, not saying that it was superior, but incorporating it with Jewish religious thought. And thus, Philo and Aristobulus, they try to deal with the wisdom literature of the Greeks as far as the wisdom literature of the Jews, the concept of the prime mover, the concept of prime light with the development of Bereshit and the first day of creation. So I'm wondering how you feel about that. Do you feel that the Jews of Alexandria did indeed contribute to Jewish thought by integrating some Hellenistic works, but not making Hellenism the prime and only...
Yeah, I mean, certainly Philo is arguing for the philosophical integrity of the Jewish religion, but also very explicitly for the moral superiority of the Jewish religion. So if you look at his biblical interpretations, there's a tinge of philosophical orientation where he's saying, look, here's another way in which the ancestral traditions of the Jews, you accuse us of being barbarians or misanthropic. Here's another example of how we are morally and philosophically perfect. Now, the Alexandrian Jews are not a monolith. And Philo criticizes Jews in Alexandria who take this too far by allegorizing their scriptures. Remember, one of the big elements of Platonic philosophy is this allegorical orientation where you have the forms, but then you have the meaning that's the truer meaning behind those physical forms. And you have Jews saying, well, I understand the allegorical meaning of circumcision. I'm not going to practice circumcision. I understand the allegorical meaning of dietary laws, Shabbat, I'm not going to keep those things. Philo calls those Jews radical allegorizers. He rejects them. He says that they're taking it too far. You have to keep those actual laws, even if you understand the allegorical meaning. But you have, you know, various ways of trying to achieve the program that Hengel talks about. So broadly speaking, yes, I agree with that. Take a book like Four Maccabees. Four Maccabees is an extreme example of a Jew who tries to apply Stoic philosophy to Jewish tradition. So Four Maccabees is an expansion of 2 Maccabees chapter 7, the story of the mother of the seven sons who's martyred at the hands of Antiochus for Epiphanes, but it's all sort of laid out as a example of Stoic perfection, Four Maccabees. So it's so philosophical, I would say that almost like clouds the Jewishness of the book in a little bit, in a way. So the only thing I have to say to supplement your comment is that there is variety within these Alexandrian Jewish texts. Philo is not 4 Maccabees, which is not 3 Maccabees, right? Which is not, I didn't even talk about Joseph and Asenath. You know, we have a lot of books that can confidently be placed in Alexandria in the late Second Temple period, and they're not a monolith. But I think broadly speaking, that's absolutely right.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure. All right. Does anyone want to verbally articulate a question, especially if you put something in the chat and I didn't address it? If not, I'll just scroll up. But we only have one more minute. Isn't the translation of the Torah one of the tragedies for which we fast? Yeah, I mean, so that's, again, I've given Shiram on this, the rabbinic text, also not a monolith, the rabbis express a lot of ambivalence about these translations, and some of them were hidden. Some targums were hidden. And there's a lot of material on this. All right. Well, I think we're gonna. Oh, wait. One thing, and then we'll go. Zella and Glenn Goldfinger.
Hi. The Heliodorus situation is so complicated, and I read it. I'm not really sure who's the good guy and who's the bad guy, and what's you know, underneath the surface. Could you just quickly?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure. I'll tell you. So Heliodorus is a bad guy. So that story at the beginning of 2 Maccabees is basically a microcosm of the whole story of the Hasmonean conflict. Basically, Heliodorus has had a series of successful military victories. He's passing through Judea. He wants to go in the temple. The people freak out. No, you cannot go in the temple. And he says, well, I'm angry at you. I don't like you anymore. Now I'm gonna raid the treasury. And I'm going to take all of your money from the Jerusalem treasury. And I'm just going to, it belongs to me now. And again, prayers, crying, it's very Hellenistic. It's very stylized. And there's a miracle. 2 miraculous angels show up and they block him. And they're on the phrase is magnificently caparisoned horses. That's what the English says. These very attractive, good looking angel men are on these beautiful horses and they basically pummel Heliodorus. And he, again, like in 3 Maccabees, he's humiliated. He leaves Judea and he's embarrassed. And this story that opens up 2 Maccabees sets the stage for, it's like a little vignette that tells us the entire book, which is essentially Antiochus 4 Epiphanes, then comes in and, oppresses the Jews, you know, says you can't keep your ancestral laws. And then we have the rebellion of Judah Maccabee. But what's interesting about 2 Maccabees is Judah Maccabee doesn't show up till chapter 8. Anyway, it's a highly recommended book. It's a diasporan book. It was written in Cyrene in modern day Libya. It's a very theologized work. I've said this many times. It's the first work to ever use the word Judaism. So I highly recommend it.
The thing about someone within the Jewish community also misappropriating funds that were supposed to be
and allow us an alchemist. Yeah, because there were Hellenized Jews supporting him. The point here, I just want to bring this back to what we've talked about today, is that these stories are circulating in different ways, right? You have 3 Maccabees about the Jews of Alexandria. You have 2 Maccabees about, you know, specifically about the Jews of Judea. You have the story of Esther, which is sort of the primary earlier source. There are stories about crises and miraculous resolutions. And these stories are traveling. That's not to say anything negative about Esther in terms of its historicity, but that it really, really resonates with diasporan Jews, right? 2 Maccabees, diasporan source, 3 Maccabees, diasporan source, Greek Esther. Well, that was actually written in Jerusalem, but it's for diasporan Jews. So these stories are really resonating with Jews in the diaspora. Next week, we are going to talk about the relationship between Jews in Judea and Jews in Egypt. And I'm so very excited to cap off this series with that because I think it's going to be a lot of fun. So I'm sorry I didn't get to all of your comments. You can email me at msimkovich@ctu.edu. Give me 24 hours and God willing, I'll get back to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Look forward to next week. Okay. In about 28 minutes, Shuli Mishkin will be giving her series on biblical archaeology. I think we're up to Shmuel Aleph today. And then this evening at 8:30, Rabbanit Leah Sarna will be giving our weekly Parshat HaShavua this week. Tomorrow morning, my share on the Siddur at 9 a.m. Menachem Liebtag kicks off the week as usual Sunday morning at 11:15. Monday, we have Rabbi Lindsay Guhartz, who is on Islam and the Jews, who recently gave a series on translations. He did 7-part series on translations toward that question at the end. You can listen. And of course, Mark Shapiro at 8:30 in the night, Rise of Reform and Traditional Response. And Tuesday morning, after Aaron Kohler's shear on Megillat Esther, Rachel Sharansky Danziger will be starting a new series, The Ins and Outs of Liberty, 10-part series, Tuesday at 11 a.m., followed by Alex Israel at 1 p.m. We keep people, you know, busy here. So, thank God we give, and then, Wednesday, what do we have? Wednesday, of course, at 11 a.m., Menachem Kellner, part 2 of his series on the Rambam and Rabbi Yehuda Levi, really more on the Rambam, the attitude of Jews towards non-Jews. That's part 2 next Wednesday. And then Dr. Sokolow, and then Mark Shapiro next week will our Jewish communities around the world. Yes, they are fascinating talk with Raphael Malik from Morocco. Next week will be in Rome, Italy. So that's at 2 p.m. And then Dr. Sokolow at 8 p.m. And then next Thursday, Malka Simkowitz back at this, you know, with the schedule. And Mordechai Turchiner will be giving the Parsha Shiur next week. Okay, that keeps you busy. Please invite a friend. And now we're down to 26 minutes to Shuli. Okay, all the best, everybody. See, so I won't end the meeting. So for those who are planning to stay, you can turn off your camera, go get some coffee. During the break, Malka says you can turn off your camera. It's only during the class you can. chance. So let everybody, we'll keep the channel open, and then at 12 o'clock, we'll be back. Okay. Have a great day, everybody. Invite a friend and be well. Bye bye.